back with Harry Cooper, taking a good look at the new volume of The Hidden Secrets of World War II, Volume 6. Okay, let me get back to the pictures here. Our gallery, if you look on the left-hand side of the top of the homepage, look for guests, tonight's guests, and click on that, and you'll go right there. All right, let's move through these pictures now. Number 9.
Yeah, a little more quickly, because there's some that are quite important.
Gotcha.
Photo 9. This was taken in Colombia during the war. The Third Reich was huge down there, more than we realized. Number 10, that's General, pronounced Lausen, not Lahausen, but Lausen. And he ran a bunch of wool stores where they'd buy wool from the farmers, and it was also used for the German spies. And photo 11, that's the remains of one of his factories, allegedly for rendering blubber and oil from seals, but other things were being built there, and you got to read the book to see that. Number 12, our special effects guy, Greg Golinski, put this together. The guy is brilliant, and I don't have to give out the phone number anymore. It's right there. And if we breeze past a photo and somebody wants to know more about it, they can send me an email there. It's on photo 12 also, sharkhunters@sharkhunters.com. Buzz it, and we'll answer the question. Now we look at photo 13. That's chapter 3. We name a bunch of the Germans who were there, not all of them because there were tens of thousands. This is where Mengele lived. I'm sorry, Eichmann. He was not protected. He had a 9-to-5 job in a factory, and which made him easy to for the Israelis, to the Mossad, to grab him. And his son, his oldest son, in protest, put up the swastika flag, and also you'll notice the Argentine flag, and he's wearing a swastika armband in protest because they had kidnapped his father. They didn't...
That's not a luxury villa, is it?
No. I've been there. That's the infamous house on Garibaldi Street. There was a book written about it. There's nothing left. It's all fenced in, nothing but rubble there. Number 14, beautiful woman named Hedwig Eva Maria Kessler, and her husband was an arms dealer in Austria, and he gave her to Hitler for one night, probably to secure a contract. She got out. She came to the United States, met Louis B. Mayer of Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer, changed her name, and we knew her as Hedy Lamarr. And she lived about 50 miles from here until she died in Central Florida. Photo 15.
And if you had it to do over again, you would have gone to visit her.
Oh, hell yes. The woman was walking history.
You bet.
And she helped invent some things for the American war effort. So
she did. She was a technology... a talent. She had patents on things.
Very intelligent lady.
Yeah.
She was Jewish, too.
Yeah.
But Hitler didn't mind rolling around in bed with her.
Oh, that whole thing.
She put that into her autobiography.
Oh, did you read it?
No, I just skimmed that part of it.
I wonder how much she... that'd be interesting. Fascinating read. It would.
I would imagine,
Wish I had time. All right, here's Priebke again. What did he do in the war? We didn't cover that early.
In photo 15, this is his son.
Yeah.
But Priebke was... he was a Hauptsturmführer, which is a captain in the SS. And towards the closing moments of the war, the partisans killed 11 German soldiers, ambushed them, and the way the rules are written, the civilians are not supposed to get into combat. So
that's
if
terrorism.
Civilians kill a soldier, the army is allowed to kill 10 civilians for every soldier that was killed, which is 11 soldiers, that's 330 civilians, and he says, hell, the war, he was in Rome. He said, the war's almost over. I don't need to do this. He got a direct order from Hitler. You must do this. So rather than just grab people off the street, he went to the mayor of Rome and said, hey, you got any criminals that are due for execution? Yeah. So they marched out 330 of them to the caves outside of Rome and killed them all. It turns out they didn't count very well, and instead of 330, they had 333. And so he was allegedly found guilty of murder of three civilians. And you look at photo number 16, and that's the guy that outed him, Sam Donaldson. And things, you know, Sam made a big splash. This was 1995. I remember it on television. And then he got to be the big hero, outed this fellow. And then along comes Senator D'Amato, who was member 4908 of Shark Hunters. He joined, you know, way afterwards. But he opened a probe into Sam Donaldson, who there was something to do with money that was questionable or something like that. And Sam Donaldson was told by Senator Al, pay back, pay back. And it never came back. So Sam Donaldson's career kind of dived a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
So
who tipped off Donaldson? That's the question. The Mossad? Somebody did.
Who knows? He went down there because there was a guy named Mahler. Real name was Reinhard Kopp. He went by the name of Juan Mahler. And if you look at photo 19, he owned that Campana Hotel, the Bell. Campana is the Bell. And that's where a lot of the guys from the Third Reich would meet during the war and after the war.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been in it. I took that photo. I took a lot of these photos, like I say. So it's not out of somebody else's book. And it's not theory. It's stuff that I was there, and
right.
I took that photo. And then here on 20, that's another one of the
nuclear lab.
Right. This is a different building. And it's still there. Unfortunately, it's no longer looked over by the government. They had the prefectura was there, the Coast Guard, and they were maintaining it. But now, Jesus, the weeds are like waist high places,
shoulder high,
and they're all stickers.
Those are wooden posts coming out of there.
Yep.
You can see some of the vertical posts that were. It was some kind of a framework around the building for some reason. We don't know. Maybe there were wires, all wires strung up on it to have
never
some.
Never figured it out.
No, I hope you can talk to that guy.
Dr. Mario Scotti.
Yeah.
21. This is an important part of the book, Chapter 5, which is titled The Fatal Accident of a Jewish Nurse. There was a beautiful young Jewish woman in Auschwitz. I guess she was in her very early 20s. And Mengele took a liking to her, so he had her sterilized so she couldn't have children, and he was banging her the whole time during the war. And the war ended, everybody scattered their own way, and in, I think it was 1961, she was a nurse, she was in her 40s, she just happened to be in Bariloche, which is at far south Patagonia. In 1961, who the hell goes to southern Patagonia? But she did, with a group of Jewish tourists. And they went to
strange.
A dance. Mm-hmm. And she and Mengele made eye contact. And remember, he had been banging her for years. So I'm sure they remembered each other. But they made eye contact for just a few seconds. He went one way, she went the other way. A couple of days later, she and her Jewish tourist friends were up in the mountains, and doggone if she didn't fall off the mountain and get killed, and they didn't find her body for 3 days. So the Jewish Times newspaper or whatever flat out said they were Mossad looking for Eichmann because they knew he was in Bariloche at that time. So this woman's accidental death, a lot like John F. Kennedy's accidental death.
Wow. So that's a picture of, picture 21 is a very good picture, actually. Interesting picture.
And he lived a lot longer than history says, you know, the stroke and drowning and all that stuff.
He drowned.
Right. Uh-huh. And one of our members, who is now passed on, he was with Dutch intelligence, and he told me his boss had a sit-down interview with Mengele a year after the so-called fatal accident. And he taped it, and he was going to send it to me, but then he was told, can't do it.
Oh, damn. All right. Yeah. Well, Mengele was didn't look like a monster at the time. You can't tell a book by its cover, except
right.
in
he was
Harry's
a little
books.
Guy.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. He looked like a 1940s Hollywood film star.
Okay.
No, he did. It was photogenic. All right, number 22. Now, this is really interesting. This is very interesting. That's on once. I want you to imagine in your mind, you're on this enormous lake, and there are fingers that go up into the backcountry that come off this lake. And the finger has one side, and then there's another side. And then the water goes on up. That's on one side of the finger of that lake that goes
right,
to 22, a certain
that's
location.
That's the so-called Saracen Tower. And we took that. Nahuel snapped it, so I gave him photo credit, but... And it's on private property, so we can't go there, except our mutual friend down there said he's got permission now. Next time I come down there, he can take me there. But that's a lot of money to go there, just take a couple photos.
What you're looking at is a 24-hour-a-day guard tower that surveilled the finger that came off the lake that went up to the Analco estate that Hitler was living in. They had that on one side. And the other side was an even much bigger fortification that was eventually blown
23.
Up.
Yeah, that was a bunker, but not a combat bunker like you saw at Lorient with 25-foot thick steel reinforced concrete wall. This was just, you know, like about 2 or 3 foot thick walls for, you know, people to live there. And that's me looking like the hood ornament on a 1948 Buick.
You do.
And that's pointing down that finger of the lake where Hitler's estate in Alco was located. And you had to pass, depending on which way you came, you couldn't get in there any other way except passing one of these two checkpoints, and your progress was noted and reported to in Alco. And they had 80 people there, including guards, and I forget which book it was. We talked about the attempt on Hitler's life sometime in the 1950s when some Soviet hitmen got there, but it didn't work out for them. They wound up on the wrong end of machine guns.
What was the group that tried to get past the observation posts and make it up the finger of the lake? Was that the Soviet group, or was that a Mossad group?
Yeah, that was the Soviet group. They came, they had a rented boat, and they spoke perfect German, and they were staying at a hotel in Bariloche. But German, the Reich, even way after the war, had security all around Bariloche. Mm-hmm. And they were watching these guys. Okay, they're six single guys. They weren't fishing, they weren't skiing, they weren't chasing women. Mm-hmm. So what were they doing there? Well, then they found out that they had been surveilling in Alco. And so they called in, it's not in this book, it's in a different book. They called in one of our members, General Adolf Galland from the Luftwaffe, who was down there at the time. And he brought in some 7.62 machine guns, and they set up the perimeter, and they got the word they were coming. And at 2 o'clock in the morning, they saw the rubber boat pulled up out front. The divers went over the side, snuck up on the beach, thought they had it easy, and all of a sudden the lights came on, the machine guns went off, and that was the end of the incursion.
They got to the beach at Inalco in front of the house?
Yeah. But then they got machine gunned.
Understood.
And the book goes into what happened to their bodies, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. All right. Wow. I remember that story. Yeah. Wasn't there another attempt at the hotel out in the middle of nowhere in Paraguay or Uruguay? I can't remember which one. Where's the hotel that's out in the middle of nowhere? Paraguay, Uruguay.
Okay. There were two of them. One was the Eden Hotel up in northern.
No, the other one.
Okay, the other one was the Hotel Vienna.
It's out in the middle of nowhere. We talked about it last time.
Okay.
We showed pictures of it. And wasn't there an attempt there to get to the hotel? But they didn't get. They were eliminated in the forest outside of it. The attempted assassins.
Paraguay. They were after Mengele.
He had his own room there, and they were trying to get him.
Right, and the owner of the hotel shoved Mengele out the window in his underwear into the jungle as the six mm-hmm. guys from Mossad were coming in, and they wound up getting their throats slashed and their bodies dumped in the jungle. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was last meeting, last time on the air, but that was Mengele, though. That wasn't Hitler.
No, I know. I knew that. Okay, number 24. A humble-looking little cottage with the upgraded new windows.
It was built by a guy named, what the hell was his name? I've gone blank. Mailer. Anyhow, this was the guy who was in charge of the security around the whole lake. Otto Mailing, that's him. And he was a tough mountaineer. He climbed up the mountain. He didn't go up on a path or a trail. We got pictures of him climbing up the side of the mountain with boards strapped to his back, and he built this place. And there's more pictures of it in this book. From his balcony, you could look out and oversee the entire lake. So one tough guy. He helped form the Club Andino, which means the Andes Club there in Bariloche, which was headquarters for spies back in the war years. And he's a tough guy. You'll see his picture in a minute.
Wow. All right, very good. Number 24. Next.
25. I know you're going to cry over this. This is the way it used to look when I was first there in 2008.
See the road there? The two, yeah. They used to make driveways like that in the States, in L.A. It'd have a two cement like that, runners that would go up into the garage, so to speak. There'd be grass in between them. But that was to drive on, to drive up to the house.
Right. And I'm standing right by the boathouse, and the lake would be off to my right shoulder. And this is the way Inalco looked before the volcano El Tronador in Chile blew up. I think it was 2011, and just spread ash all over everything and made a mess of things, and nobody cleaned it up, and the place looks like hell right now. It's really sad, falling apart.
I had an email. Somebody was saying that he heard that German investors had bought it, and I had to correct him. No, the word is that Israelis have bought the 1,700 acres, and we can only hope that they are smart enough to go for the money and restore everything and turn it into an eagle's nest south.
We sure hope it's renovated because it's history, and it's beautiful. Last time I was there just before the Kung Flu scamdemic, I had a group there, and we spent the night there. It's been abandoned ever since Hitler moved out in 55, but the house was not suitable, so we stayed in one of the guest houses, which I believe is the one that Don Angel Alcazar de Velasco stayed in 1952 when he flew down there to give photos of some children and some reports to Hitler. But that's another whole story.
It sure is, yeah. Wow. All right, there it is. If you haven't seen it before, that is Inalco. And there were many other buildings off to the left out there. You can't see outbuildings for people who took care of the place. It was completely self-sufficient. They raised all their own food, everything.
To the left of the picture there, there were three guest houses. But then if you go about another 500 or more meters, you come onto the farm area. And those buildings are all still standing, too, the where they raised the cattle, the racehorses. They also raised Great Danes, which were originally guard dogs for the German aristocracy centuries ago. Mm-hmm. And that's all falling apart. And unfortunately, Highway 40 was put through in the last 10 years, I guess. And it goes right along the fence line of the farm, and vandals are coming in there, and it's really sad. They ought to shoot somebody who's vandalizing history. But moving along.
Oh, I've had to pay for some of that vandalism dearly. But I got it fixed. Okay.
Remember.
Hitler's birthday in Bariloche.
And the guy circled, that's Otto Mehling, the guy who climbed the mountain with all the boards on his back. And he set up the intel and the espionage, or whatever you want to call it, the security service around there. So that's Otto Mehling. These are all people who loved Germany, and you'll notice whose picture is right in the middle there. It's Hitler's.
Yep.
And those celebrations on the 20th of April went on way after the war ended. Way after.
Look at Mehling's eyes are very intense. This guy's not going to be denied. Yeah, you can see how tough he is.
Yep.
Interesting.
Hey, anybody that climbs the side of a mountain with boards strapped to his back, tough guy.
You bet. All right. Number 20. No, we're going to be one back. I got to go back one. Number
27.
Who's this nice-looking blonde lady with the arm spasm?
Yeah, that's the Roman salute. And I found out from Jeff Carson that that salute was being taught to children in the U.S. before the war started, and it didn't have any negative connotation. But anyhow, this is the president of Argentina, Isabelita Perón. She was Juan Perón's third wife. And this photo was taken in 1974. 74. The war ended in 45. There was no more Third Reich after 35, so it says. However, this was her with a very bad salute. That thumb is not supposed to be sticking out. It's supposed to be up alongside your index finger. But maybe she didn't have time to practice.
Oh, it was a thought that counts. Okay.
Yeah. I wrote to her a couple of times after she got kicked out of power. She moved to Spain, and I wrote to her several times to arrange an interview, but she never replied, and why would she? She's living a life of luxury. Why would she rock the boat?
Right.
Too bad.
Very good. All right. That looks like a major address somewhere that's being covered by Channel 7, at least one television
outlet. It was right after her husband's death. Right after Perón's death. And she became the president of Argentina.
Right.
Only to get overthrown by the military very quickly.
That's an old theme. Abandoned German mine.
Yep.
Number 28.
Yep. That's on the road. We passed this thing, our friend Martin and I passed there, and he said, you got to stop and take a picture of this. I said, why? Well, it was a German mine. I said, yes, so what? Oh, then we find it's mining, I think it was vanadium or something like that, during the war, which is necessary in making hard steel. So, war's over, mine's abandoned.
Got it.
Oh, well.
Okay. Number
item 29. Yeah, that's from Chapter 8, Pais Amigo, which means friendly country, I guess. This was another Third Reich gathering by Lake Ranco, which is in Chile, but it's only, if I remember correctly, like 40, 50 kilometers from in Alco. And if you look closely, a lot of the important people are identified down there at the bottom. I don't know who these people are, but these celebrations went on for a long time after the war.
Wow. Okay. That's very interesting. All right. Now, number 30.
This goes into a very important chapter, the training camps post-war. Now, this area was training camps during the war for German people in Argentina. And I went there with Martine, 4 or 5 years ago. I took this photo. You're buzzing down the superhighway or the highway, whatever. It's four-lane divide, and you're buzzing along. There's forest all over the place. All of a sudden, he stands on the brakes. There's an opening about 10 feet wide in the trees. He ducks in there, and we pass an abandoned building that had been a security checkpoint. Then about a quarter mile later, we come to this tunnel, which is only one car wide. And we go through there, and you go through about a mile or 2 miles back into the woods, and suddenly it's pasture land. And then there's buildings all over the place. This used to be a training camp. And when did it stop being a training camp? We don't know, but it was well past post-war. You look at photo 31. 31 is a religious grotto, and I took this photo also. You go down the stairs into this grotto, and there are candles in there that had been lit just a day or two before.
Isn't it strange
you fill
thing.
In the blanks.
Yeah. Yeah.
Then the next photo, 32, that's their swimming pool that is no longer in use, but you notice the greenery is not growing up so much. So this thing has only gone out of use maybe a year or two before I took the photo.
And this is through the tunnel. This is still through the tunnel, yes?
Oh, yeah. This is the whole facility about 2 miles into the forest.
Didn't we at one point, didn't you suggest that this might have been a destination for people who were going to go through the plastic surgery new identity program, and they were being
holding area.
Kind of debriefed there and all that?
That's what rebriefed. We found. Yep, that's what our...
That's a big damn pool. Look at that.
Oh, it is. Yeah. It is. Bigger than an Olympic-sized pool. And look at all those little cutouts in there, whatever you call that, the little alcoves where you change clothes.
They were ready for
a lot of people.
Little dressing rooms, whatever.
Yeah, there you go.
This was, so many people from Germany did make it to Argentina, and a lot of them went to this location, we think, to be processed, given new identities, whatever. And then there was a plastic surgery clinic as well.
Nearby. This was in northern Germany. Northern Argentina. I think it was in Cordoba province. And up there in that area was the Hotel Vienna, with only one N in Vienna, which had been running. It was built in the closing moments of the war, 1945. It had elevators. It had air conditioning. And it had a 60-meter-high lookout tower. What the hell do you need a lookout tower for at a resort on a lake? It was a salt lake in northern Argentina. And for some reason, the salt lake rose, and went up to the ceiling of the first floor and destroyed the hotel and then receded. But before that happened, one of our members, who turned out to be a wimp and a half, he was there, and he was going to tell us all about it, which he did tell some of it. He was there in 1960 or 61, I think it was, something like that, and he said it was full of Germans, And the plastic surgery clinic was going almost round the clock.
Wow.
But then, like I say, it flooded, and we were there. This was, what, 10 years ago, I guess, because I was still using Nahuel, what the hell was his name?
Coca,
yeah. He was my guide. And we went there. We were supposed to be there at noon to meet the lady who had the keys, because it's all surrounded by chain link fence. And
right.
Noon, we get there. Oh, she couldn't make it for a while, so, you know, have lunch. So we had lunch. She still couldn't make it. Suddenly, she wasn't going to be able to make it until 6 o'clock at night. And we still had 2 or 3 hours drive to get back to where we came from. So one of the skills I learned working for the Mustaches in Chicago, I picked the lock. We went in. We don't take anything. We never take anything but photos and film. We filmed the whole place. Everything in there was German. German pictures, German signs. There was even swastikas in there, not just graffiti.
Well, I've seen
but
some
actual
of those pictures you shared. They're
right.
Remarkable.
And if I ever learn how to do Rumble, I'm going to put them all up. And so finally we saw everything we needed to see. We locked mm-hmm. up again, and we're in the car. We're about an hour down the road, and this is out in the pampas. There ain't a damn thing out there except cows and tumbleweeds. And his phone rings, Nahuel's phone rings. Oh, si, senor. Yeah, si, senor. And he's acting, oh, no, senora, por favor, no policia, no policia, no policia. She was going to call the police on us. So we made a deal. I told her how I was able to penetrate their security if she wouldn't call the cops. So,
what was her pretense for calling the cops? Trespass?
Mm-hmm, yeah. Well, we picked the lock, for God's sake. You're not supposed to do that.
Yeah.
But we never touched anything. We never hurt anything. We never took anything. We just don't do that. We're not vandals.
No.
So then you look at photo number 33. And who's that good-looking guy in the mirror? That's me. This is the large shower building, and the, you know, you got the sink there for the toothbrushing and the razors and all. And off behind me, you see the showers. The water was still running. The water.
Where is this? The plastic surgery clinic? What is
this? No, this is still that compound.
Oh, you're still there. All right.
Yeah, right up from the swimming pool, mm-hmm, about 100 mm-hmm, yards mm-hmm. away from the swimming pool. And the water was still running. The water heaters were still on because we had hot water. And you see by that blue cloth, somebody was there doing something before us. So
wow.
We didn't see a lot of people. There was a caretaker and about 3 or 4 other people there. But mm-hmm. is it still being used? Somebody's using it.
Well, those are an awful lot of dressing rooms around that huge pool. So there were a lot mm-hmm. of people there. A lot of people. All right. Let's move ahead now. Number 34. This is a classic picture. Those are not GIs in the photograph. And what are they doing? And where are they? Let's see if you can figure that out. We'll give them 10 seconds. What do you think they're doing there?
Do we play the music from Jeopardy while everybody's thinking? Yeah, this is Hitler's personal quarters in the Führer bunker in Berlin. This is where Hitler and Eva Braun committed suicide, allegedly. So, according to published history, Eva Braun was sitting at the far end of the sofa, which I've got with the yellow circle. Well, if she was sitting there, how come there's all this blood there? She didn't shoot herself. She allegedly took a pill. So why is there blood there? Now, if you look where the red triangle is, that's where Hitler was allegedly seated. And he put the gun to his right temple and fired. If that's the case, the bullet would have come out the left side of his head and would have been all over where the blue circle is. That's where the blood spatter would have been. So could it be somebody lied?
In other words, did somebody go in there with a large cup full of blood and pour it all over that other end of the sofa and on the floor? And that's what appears to have happened.
Yeah, and all the reports of history said that Hitler put the gun to his right temple. You look at 35. That ain't no
right
temple.
By the way, these are one sec. These are Soviet troops, and they're among the very first in the bunker. You see, they've got a candle. They don't even have lights in there. He's looking at the floor. This is a flash picture, obviously. Mm-hmm. And they're one of the very first in there. You can see blood down the side of the arm of the end of the sofa at one location. Then the bottom where you sit is covered with a lot of red, and it was on the floor as well. That's the story. That's supposedly where Adolf Hitler committed suicide.
Right.
Didn't happen.
And
go ahead.
According to the three so-called eyewitnesses, look at 35. The bullet wound is in the forehead, not in the right temple, and that ain't Hitler.
But it's supposed to be Hitler.
That was his cousin, Joseph Sillip, who looked like him and came from the same area. So the three guys who told that they were eyewitnesses, they told the Soviets under pressure.
Mm-hmm.
Anyhow, there were three guys. They all had Obersturmführer, I forget what the rank is, but they were majors in the SS. Linge, who was Hitler's butler, Kempke, who was his driver, and Gunche, who you see in photo 36, was his adjutant. And each one of them said that they were witnesses. Well, it turned out two of them, nobody was in there when this alleged suicide happened. Nobody was in that room. And two of them said they heard the shot. And one of them said that he smelled the gunpowder from a gun being fired. And each one of them listed the time that they heard or smelled. And it was vastly different. Two of the guys said that Hitler was seated beside Eva Braun on the sofa, and that Eva Braun's dress was wet because Hitler apparently knocked over a flower vase and soaked her dress when he shot himself. And they were both seated. The third guy said that Hitler was sitting in the chair next to the sofa, mm-hmm. and that Eva Braun was laying out on the sofa. Now, how do you make a mistake like that? You know, two guys said he was sitting beside her. One guy said he was sitting over in the chair. Two guys said Eva Braun was sitting up. One guy says she was laying down. And we go into it in this chapter that apparently, according to our agent who wrote this particular chapter, this was a carefully designed code so that people later on would look at it and say, hey, wait a minute, Hitler didn't do this. This is all smoke and mirrors.
Right.
And the guy in picture 36, Otto Gunche, he was a big guy, 6'8", I think it was. And he was dear friends with my best lady friend over there, Ingrid Scharfenberg. And she saw
the hotel owner.
Yes, yeah. The hotel owner who got clipped, but that's another story.
Yeah.
She was a sweetheart. She was about 4'10", weighed maybe 90 pounds, just as sweet as could be unless you crossed her. Holy cow. She was you just didn't want to cross Ingrid. So anyhow, they were good friends. And Ingrid was with Gunche right around the time of his 88th birthday. And he was in great shape. This picture was taken by Ingrid. And his wife had finally passed away. So theory was that he kept his mouth shut about what really happened because his wife could have been threatened. But now his wife is gone. And theory was that he was going to tell the story. So a little while after his 88th birthday, he was found in the sauna by his housekeeper. He had been in the sauna from one afternoon all the way through until the next morning, and the temperature was set at 85 degrees centigrade, which is about 180 degrees Fahrenheit.
Doggone
accidents happen.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what happened with Günther. Linga and Kempka, they died many, many moons before. So the last guy who knew the true story, he wound up dying in the sauna. Accidentally, yeah. Of course.
Oh, yeah. How many? They killed so many millions of Germans after the war ended. 8 to 10
Yeah, too many people that could talk.
And the nationalist movement was still there, and they could have helped resurrect Germany one more time, but they killed them all.
Hmm.
Wow.
Yeah. Imagine
the bunker,
that, Rens. We got done with the photos before the clock ran out. That's rare for us.
I find that hard to believe. I guess you better get the banjo out. Here's the deal.
Pipes. I used to play the bagpipes.
Yeah, that would be good. This whole story, we wouldn't know 1/100th of it without you. I'm not blowing smoke your way. I'm just telling it like it is. The work Harry has done over 40 years is peerless. And all these programs you see on the History Channel and so forth, they're all derivative of his work. If they're not complete fiction, they just make stuff up if they need it to tell the story that they're trying to sell. So if you want the truth, join Shark Hunters. Get the books. He's got videos, he's got DVDs, a lot of stuff. It's not just what we've talked about, there's more. But if you want to know the truth, it's there, as much of it as we can assemble. And there's still a lot of the story that's not ascertained. We know where the pilot lived, who flew the big Junkers 390, 2A, yep. I guess it was, with, in all likelihood, Hitler and Eva Braun and others and their luggage, their personal effects. We don't know. It was a big plane. And that plane flew around the world, apparently, several times, so it could make it down there easily. And it did. And Harry's been to the landing strip where, out in the country, where they lit up flares and marked off where the landing area was, and the plane came down. And there were witnesses to that he actually talked to.
Yeah.
And they're still there. At least they were 10 years ago.
Yeah.
And it's quite a story.
I don't know if they're still there. They were in their late 80s, early 90s. These were mostly the widows. The men had died. You know, they were farmers. And it was a German community that went in 1920-something, I think, 1918. And there was a very flourishing farming community, but eventually the men died off, and the women, widows, were living in real squalor. The houses we were in, some of them had no windows. They just had burlap sacks hanging over the window holes, and there were junk cars.
They were just waiting out their time with their memories. And the one that you talked to, did she not have a tattoo or two?
I was thinking about her. Yeah, she said, no, there were no Nazis here, and she's got three swastikas tattooed on her right forearm. Got a picture of that.
Uh-huh. Well, they didn't think of themselves as Nazis either. They thought of themselves as Germans.
Yeah, exactly. Nazi was a term coming up with the Brits.
And you might also say, I'm condensing a lot of things, but what happened to the airplane? Well, we know where the pilot lived, ostensibly the pilot. We know who he was. His place was, until he died, it was hidden away. And after he died, there were people who went in there and took pictures of the place before it was completely stripped of its belongings. Some of his clothing and things were still there. His beautiful coat that he got in Berlin, obviously. It's called a walking coat, a beautiful coat from the 1930s, mid-30s, I guess. Anyway, we think he flew the plane down there. What happened to the plane?
Well, we know what happened to the plane, but...
Yes.
Allegedly, according to the fictitious history, it landed on the Estancia. I forget the name of the guy that owned the Estancia, but I talked to his daughter. I interviewed her. Allegedly, the plane landed, and the people got out. This is in Uruguay, right outside a little town called Paysandú. Beautiful little town. Loaded with Germans, and we went to a big German restaurant outside the town. I don't speak Spanish, but I get along fine with my German down there. So anyhow, allegedly, the farmhands, this thing landed about midnight. The farmhands totally disassembled this airplane and threw the parts into the nearby river. Well, you know, that's a nice story. However, this thing was the size of a 757, although it had recip engines, props, six of them. To think uneducated, untrained, unskilled farmhands could disassemble a plane of that size in 5 or 6 hours and
that's
then
laughable.
Dump all the remains in the river, it just boggles the mind that anybody would believe that. And plus the fact there's no parts in the river. We got this from our mutual friend, the spy. Mm-hmm. It was flown up to Paraguay, and it was still in a hangar up there meant some years ago. And I asked our friend, the spy, to tell me where it was, because I have no problem playing stupid when the cops come. Talk down yonder hillbilly, and I would get away. He says, no, these are not police. These are private guards with orders to shoot to kill. So I said, okay, I don't think I'll go there. So the plane allegedly last flew in 1966, I believe it was. But it's probably no longer in existence. Too bad.
Might it be sequestered away in a hangar somewhere in the jungle? We talked about that at one point.
Yeah,
is that still possible?
It would be in Paraguay. Mm-hmm. And our friend the spy would know. I haven't talked to him in a while, so maybe I'll ring his bell tomorrow.
He started a new online
recently?
Something. I got an email from him a couple of weeks ago, not anything elaborate. He started a new online thing, and very, very interesting man.
Oh, yeah, ask brilliant him. Guy.
Oh, yeah. Oh, he's like a library. He's incredible.
Yeah, incredibly smart. Speaks I don't know how many languages.
Nine or ten.
And he's the one who showed me the tunnel in Salzburg, where some of the hierarchy of the Third Reich and the Allied leaders got together after the surrender.
Mm-hmm.
But there were some crack SS troops, Waffen SS troops, holding back the Red Army while the negotiations were finalized for certain people's escape, etc.
Mm-hmm.
So I was in Vienna, and he showed me where it was. And so I went into it. The first part of it, closest to the entrance, is being used by the city for truck storage, et cetera. But I could see it went way down beyond that. So here I go, fat, dumb, and happy with my camera running. And some guy comes running up yelling at me in German. I know what he was saying, but I'm just, yeah, right. I'm from mm-hmm. the South in America. Now I'm a tourist. I'm here to take pictures. No. And he's yelling at me to get out. Yeah, okay, whatever you're saying, buddy. And I kept right on walking past him till finally he physically blocked my movements and told me in German to get the hell out. Meanwhile, our spy friend is out there laughing his ass off. But
that's funny.
The tunnel is there.
That's funny. There's something obviously way inside there that is of still importance.
Yep,
that's
in
very
there.
Interesting. No, I'll ask him about that sometime. That's a mm-hmm. very interesting little side note. So many side notes. So many things.
Yeah,
he knows
our,
a lot. Wow.
Our trips over there have been cut short now, thanks to the Kung Flu scamdemic, and also our angel. Has died, Jack Goodyear, is a multi-zillionaire, and he was very interested in this history, but his health wouldn't let him travel. So every time he'd come up with something to look into, he'd send me a letter. I'd get a letter and a check for $5,000. Go check it out. I'd be on an airplane with the camera going and bring it back and tell it to Jack. Unfortunately, his health let him down, and he died a few years ago.
Well, I remember you.
And the other guy, too, who was helping was the duck man, as they called him. His name was Entenmann, and that was Charlie Entenmann, the guy that owned Entenmann's bakeries, Entenmann's cookies, et cetera, et cetera.
Pastries.
Yeah.
He was a big brand, still around.
Oh, yeah, well, he sold it, and he retired to a ultra-high-buck gated community on the north end of Key Largo, Florida, and that was where Frank Gifford, the football player, was living, and various. But Entenmann had the number one spot. We went to visit him one time, and you go down this long, long road, and there was a deputy's car sitting there, not a rent-a-cop. This was a Monroe County deputy, and you get to the entrance. And there's a Monroe County deputy there, plus the guy at the gate. Oh, yes, is Mr. Entenmann expecting you? I said, yeah. And I told him my name. Well, okay. Do you know where his house is? I said, no. He says, you keep going on this road till you run out of road. And that's his place. Well, I go. And then we go over a little bridge, and there's an island about 100 yards, maybe 150 yards in diameter. And there was this castle on there. And here comes Charlie Entenmann, dressed just like anybody else, jeans and a shirt, but not ostentatious. Hi, Harry. I'm Charlie. Nice to meet you. So he's gone.
Well, if anybody wants to step up and fill that role of angel, it would be very much appreciated. Those kinds of things make things happen.
So yeah, and we have a 501c3, so anybody wants to donate, it's tax-deductible.
All right.
And if you go back to photo 12, that tells how to get a hold of us.
Hidden Secrets of World War II, Volume 6, by Harry Cooper. And it's right there in the images. You can go to sharkhunters.com, get yourself a copy. It's shipping right now, and many more to come. It's fascinating to find out what really happened. It couldn't be more interesting. Thank you. Wonderful job, as always.
Thank you.
Keep it up.
My pleasure.
All right. See you, Harry. Okay.
All right. Good night, guys.
Admiral Cooper and the one and only sharkhunters.com. Okay. We'll be right back. Hang on.